is April 16th, and in the Squamish lands at Kitsilano 6, a 3,000 rental unit development is planned. This is the Camby Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Patrick Meehan.
Here we are at the Drive Coffee House just before our Alberta election watching party. For those of you who are wondering why you haven't heard of this, you should join our Patreon, which is available at patreon.com/CambyReport. Say it.
Patreon.com/CambyReport.
That is correct. Patreon.com/CambyReport gets you access to not only our Slack channel, but also exclusive invites to wonderful events such as this Alberta election watching party, which we are about to go into. And then, of course, probably be pretty disappointed. But that disappointment aside, let us move on to our news items. There is a hell of a lot of news, or at least some momentous news, going on in Vancouver today, starting, of course, at the foot of the Burrard Street Bridge.
So Frances Bueller got the scoop, as is, you know, normal in Vancouver. Essentially, somebody told her to take a look at the Squamish Band Council agenda for their upcoming meeting. She did, and she saw that the debate was on about whether or not to go to referendum on building 3,000 units of housing at the Burrard Street Bridge, which is obviously going to be interesting, contentious, and possibly a wild argument in Vancouver. The rough details are that the Squamish Band has some amount of land left. Now, there's a UBC piece that you can go to watch watch each iteration of the land getting ripped away from them through the course of the 20th century that we can probably link in the show notes. And what essentially they have now left is a bit of land that abuts the Seaforth Armory on the north side of it, goes out to False Creek, and then across to more or less one block in from 4th Avenue, and then like a T-shape moves northward. It's an interesting one. If you Google Kitsilano 6 on Google Maps, you'll be able to get a good look at the map. So that land is fairly narrow in scope, but it looks like, and we've talked to some developer contacts that we have, and it looks like they're fairly confident that 3,000 units seems within the realm of possibility, and the Squamish Band is going to go to referendum on whether or not to make it rental, essentially. And that's the next question.
Well, so far the response to this project has been almost overwhelmingly positive for what is a massive development in what's traditionally a very single-family home neighborhood in Vancouver. You see any other project generate lots and lots of opposition, and I think this time we finally see people going, well, it is their land. We did steal it from them. This is all they have left, and maybe the best thing we can do is just go, all right. But that didn't stop a couple people, some community figures, as it were, from getting their voice out there, and this great headline in City News 1130 comes out that says, Kitsilano residents hope First Nation will consult them on massive development plan.
Which the I think Walking Eagle News, the Onion article for Indigenous news issues, retweeted that comment with, we wish we had come up with this headline. There is one other component to it, though, that's interesting, is the Molson Lands sold a couple of years ago to developers. Molson Lands being between this Squamish land and the Burrard Armory, or the Seaforth Armory, which I sort of slightly misspoke there. And those lands, interestingly enough, sold for a ridiculous amount of money. I think it was something like $150 million to developer or to an offshore organization that wants to redevelop it into residential. Well, their view of the north just poof, as buildings are going to go in between them and the mountains.
How does this project affect the view cones for Kitsilano?
Well, there are no view cones west of Granville Island, and so there really aren't. View cones really are interestingly restricted to a part of the city that is almost exclusively in the west side of Vancouver, but is not as far out as we often think of it. And so that doesn't actually impact view cones in this situation.
They've been entering into non-binding negotiations with Westbank, which is a property developer responsible for, among other things, the Shangri-La. And so that kind of indicates to me that there is a potential for some condo development, but it's not exactly... Basically, what we're going to have to do is wait until the referendum question gets put to the Squamish Nation and then see what that looks like.
And Westbank has also done a number of social housing projects. Notably, they did the Woodwards building, amongst others. So they have really, over the last 10 years, as you noted, Matthew, carved themselves out as an upscale developer.
Yeah.
That being said, I mean, they are a premier developer in the city, and there are not a lot of development firms that are large enough to manage development of that scope.
The last thing I'll note is Mike Howell explored this question in the Courier on, is this actually reconciliation. And with that kind of headline, I was very cynical going into it. But he actually does a fairly kind of nuanced discussion of what does this actually mean. And
yeah, you were saying,
I think Hasaalem's quoted in there. He talks about how he talked to Ian Campbell in the past, who we've talked to in the past when he was running for mayor. And there's some like neat aspects to it, because it's going to be the city that's ultimately responsible for building like the infrastructure within this project, the roads, the pipes, and all of that. But the Squamish Nation are the ones building the actual buildings. And so that kind of relationship is an interesting one. It'll be interesting to see how that goes forward.
And making a profit off of it too, right? This is a profit motive, you know? One of the things that has been floated out there is that this will help the band council be able to afford to build more housing for their own people.
Well, and this is the thing, is that reconciliation isn't a process of reparations. Like, that's certainly part of it, but it is a component there.
It is
the two parties reconciling themselves to each other. Like, there are things that Canada has to make, you know, amends for, certainly. There also isn't going to be any way to dial back the clock to 1750. So reconciling in a way to move forward in a positive and productive way, I would say that that's reconciliation, but certainly, what is more Vancouver than property development?
Indeed.
Well, one place that's not super excited about property development is a little bit further into the Fraser Valley, where you get to Maple Ridge. Technically, I'm right.
I'm going to really question whether Maple Ridge is the Fraser Valley.
It's in that direction, relative to Vancouver.
In the sense that they're both east of us.
Yes. There, Mayor Mike Morden has drawn some extra controversy. The city there has been opposed to the province's temporary modular homes and literally any action, it seems, to house the homeless who are out there. And he was recorded in a 30-minute YouTube interview where he makes this longer statement where he says, "I see us becoming, for some reason, a hotspot in the Lower Mainland for people coming here to carry on doing drugs and basically raping and pillaging all of our community and our businesses, and that's got to stop."
I can't believe this guy exists.
Rape is sexual assault and pillage is looting and arson. Seriously, people need to have some fucking perspective.
Morden was asked about this and whether he would walk back or apologize for his comments, and he said the words were, quote, "an expression of frustration and probably weren't appropriate." He did add, though, according to this one article, that his comments were a reflection of the frustrations felt by citizens and businesses about prolific theft he feels is being driven by drug addiction.
He feels it's being driven. He doesn't have any stats to back it up, mind you. But
well, and this came out heavily on Twitter because he, I think, managed to find one stat where year over year, crime did increase in Maple Ridge, which...
However, as Justin McElroy at the CBC did some pretty significant work liaising with the local RCMP out there, at the end of the day, they released a lot of data. There was a pretty significant spike in crime in the immediate months before the municipal election, which may be why this was so torqued. But by and large, crime hasn't really changed significantly over the last several years there. Maybe it's 5% higher or 15% higher over a 10-year run, but it's not you know, this like prolific issue that the mayor seems to say.
And it's becoming quite the hotbed of tension between the municipal and the provincial government because you have Selena Robinson, whose riding covers part of Maple Ridge.
And Bob Deeth as well, whose riding is also partially...
Yeah, so you have two high-profile NDP MLAs, both who clearly want to be reelected. And Selena Robinson is a housing minister, so she's there at the front lines announcing these temporary modular housing projects.
She gets a lot of the blame and a lot of the congratulations.
And the protests are at her door.
Mm-hmm.
So they announced a 51-unit temporary modular housing project in Maple Ridge on provincial-owned land.
Yeah, which we covered in the episode with Matthew and I. No, it's so mind-boggling that this tempest in a teapot over 51 units to house people who are already there. It's so out of touch with how your community actually is. Speaking of being out of touch with how your community is, the city of Delta, Lois Jackson and I agree on something.
Stop the presses, the clock is wrong, whatever. Sorry, stops clocks right twice a day? I've mixed metaphors before.
So Four Winds has proposed to the city that they put in a 200-seat bar, brewery, essentially, facility in Swanson. The idea there would be it would be a combination of that as well as their canning facility for their brewery. Well, while it is zoned for that bar, it is not zoned for industrial usages, which apparently putting beer in cans counts as.
Well, canning is a traditional industry of that area, with Richmond especially having some very historic canneries. Only instead of beer, they tended to put salmon and other fish products in.
Slightly different, yes. Yeah, there were a couple of other really minor little bits and bobs added to it, but by and large, that was the proposal. And so it's been shot down now on a narrow 5-4 ruling. Lois Jackson, former mayor, now city councilor, said that she actually thinks it should go forward. She doesn't think it's perfect, but it should go forward. Because at the end of the day, if Brown Social House wants to put in a 200-seat bar there, they can. And Delta could support their local business and support their tourism industry, in a sense. Or they could allow some other commercial chain bar to come in there, and they can't really control it at that point.
Well, it was interesting because one of the swing votes on this was the new mayor, George Harvey, mm-hmm. who was a close, I'm assuming still close, political ally of Lois Jackson.
They'd run on the same slate.
And for them to kind of split on this is almost surprising. Do we have any insight into the fault line here?
Well, I think,
fun is bad.
Well, I think Lois Jackson has always been somebody who goes to her own tune. She's never been one to sort of go along just because the team is going one way, right? Which is, you know, it's like oftentimes viewed as commendable, oftentimes viewed as being not a team player. It depends, I think, on the eye of the beholder. And also, obviously, there's gendered lenses that can be applied there, too.
From a lack of fun in South Delta to, oh, and now announcing a terrible joke.
There's Ian? So many terrible jokes.
No. I like this one. Let's build it up. Let's build it up so that it's even worse when it lands like a lead balloon. Ian.
So a couple weeks ago, we talked about Vancouver Council and its decision to end funding to the Vancouver Rape Relief Society, commonly viewed as a turf organization. And now we're going to talk about how Vancouver Park Board is being overrun by the anti-turfs. Patrick.
So everyone sort of tuned into Park Board because they've got this fun motion, these two big motions that were there. We'll get to those in a sec. Those were namely the 420, the 420 rally motion, as well as the motion around golf courses, the city-owned golf courses. But the first thing was up was a proposal to put in a turf field in attached to one of the high schools in Vancouver. This was opposed by a number of people who, most from what I could gather, most of whom indicated some level of green support historically, on the basis that turf gives off toxins, is impermeable, could be a cancer-causing agent to children, and other odd Parks and Rec moments.
Do we have any evidence that this was an AstroTurf anti-turf group?
I thought that was going to be a real question at first. But yeah, so we all got to enjoy this fun turf war before we jumped into the real turf war, which is over the 420 resolution and the golf courses. Which do we want to hit first?
Let's go with 420, because basically this is a question as to whether or not the 420 quote-unquote rally is indeed a rally anymore or simply a party, and what the park board can do to basically recoup costs of the
event.
Yeah. Like, event, yeah.
So the
Sunset Beach the crux was destroyed.
Well, the crux of it really comes down to the 420 rally doesn't get a permit as a normal festival or rally because they view themselves as being a social change act, basically. So, you know, if you hold a political rally at the Vancouver Art Gallery, you don't have to do the whole permitting process that you normally do. You don't have to pay for a lot of it. But if you want to do, say, the St. Patrick's Day parade, you have to pay for the permit and whatnot. And so in this situation, the 420 rally organizers have not been getting a permit for a number of years now. They sell booth space to people to sell merchandise. They are bringing in Cypress Hill, notably, to do a concert, among other things. And as you know, Matthew, as you pointed out, although I quibble with whether or not this is an important point, they do tend to result in a significant amount of repair having to happen to the park.
Yeah, didn't they? They had to close the grass at Sunset Beach for a while last year. It was.
Yeah, but I tend to think that just because there's a maintenance issue doesn't mean we shouldn't have fun as a city.
No, I agree that we should have the thing, but like there are ways to recoup those costs by putting down those like grass protectors, for example. Like, yep. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do it. I'm saying that.
Well, it's just we also have a situation where we've had festivals become non-profitable and have to shut down over the last couple of years because of increased costs being downloaded onto them.
Well,
right?
If you go to cannabis Twitter, which is definitely a thing, where I don't spend time, but it gets retweeted into my feed, you find a lot of people questioning the park board justifications and going, well, did they really need to close it down that long? And suddenly everyone's become a very strong expert in grass maintenance.
And actually, I've seen the same from last year. And honestly, I'm not sure they had to close it down for that long. You know, I would want to look into it more and get more detailed information, but it did seem like it was an excessive shutdown. Now, Councillor Sarah Kirby-Young has also been heavily involved in this because in previous years when she was on Park Board, she also consistently fought against the 420 rally from happening on park facilities. And so now she's been once again going after her, and Jody Emery have been having a flame war on Twitter for like a week or two now, and so on. It's an interesting question. At the end of the day, I mean, the question is, yeah, while you were protesting, you know, prohibition of cannabis, that was a thing. But now maybe you should get, now you're a celebration rally, maybe you should get a permit like Pride does.
Yeah, well, my personal opinion on this is, like, you won. Congratulations. you have succeeded in all your hopes and dreams, and certainly some stuff has to be worked out around the regulation of edibles. But, like, that's not enough to hold a rally that is very much a hire a suit and tie lobbyist to go and work out the nitty gritty details of. There is like a measure of social responsibility and kind of regulatory buy-in that once you have succeeded to force your agenda into the national zeitgeist, that you have to abide by. Congratulations, you won. You're part of Main Street Society. You have to abide by Main Street Society's regulatory rules.
Another component of the Park Board motion was to call upon the organizers to cancel the Cypress Hill concert, which forced Park Board commissioners to debate the value of a Cypress Hill concert at a 420 event, which I believe Commissioner Camille Dumont had the line of the night with, a Cypress Hill concert at 420 is insane on the membrane.
And as there is no way to top that, let us move along.
From one piece of grass to the grass that covers Vancouver's golf courses, as we teased, the other part of what Park Board was debating that everyone was looking forward to was this deep dive motion that the Park Board wants to study the point of our golf courses.
Turf can truly be abrasive and impermeable.
So it got overblown, I think. If you look at the wording in the motion, and I think Park Board Commissioner Demers, I think his goal was to look at ways to improve the golf courses and analyze their business case, rather than to shut them down or turn them into some kind of a green space that's truly green and not a weird hellscape of lawn. And so what ends up coming out of this is everyone thinks that this motion is whether or not to shut down the golf courses. Notable information that comes out of it is 15% of all parkland in Vancouver is golf course, and there's been a 30% reduction in the use of city-owned golf courses since the 90s.
Have they considered giving all politicians and past politicians free use of the golf courses?
Which, by the way, didn't Derek Horgan, it came out today that he had spent, that he had billed something like $20,000 in free golf course use?
I missed that, but I do know that Burnaby...
Oh yeah, we can update that.
Yeah, the Burnaby Council did vote to cap golf course fees after they learned that they are the only municipality that in the Lower Mainland that gives politicians this free access to Municipal Parks and Rec Services, PERC.
So, which, I mean, like, I somehow am both in favor of them giving free access and also blowing up the golf courses, so...
Well, it is interesting, right? Like, if you know, Dude Chilling Park gets way more people per capita to it on any given sunny day than I think all of the than any given golf course. But the golf course takes up 10 times as much space. And so that is a real question. Now, the motion calls for ways to improve aviary support and things like that. So maybe we're just looking at tweaks on the margins here. Which
aviary support and tweets on the margins really does describe the bird habitat in Vancouver.
True. Park Board Commissioner Demers did sort of do a walk back. He said, next time I won't tweet, which basically is to say that he realized that his motion got sort of blown significantly out of proportion. And, you know, maybe it is a much more minor issue. But it did get a lot of the journalism sphere to pay attention to Park Board for a night. So there's a win.
This is actually, I think, the first time we've covered Park Board, maybe. Maybe we've talked about it once before, maybe with the whales, but we keep meaning to talk about Park Board more, and then we're like, but what do they do?
Yep.
They set policy for, without actually determining operational issues. I am still unconvinced as to the merits of having a Park Board, but that is a discussion for another time.
Well, let's finish back at Vancouver Council, where some councillors are spending some money. And Patrick, you've been doing some digging on this, as in talking to one of our sources.
I've done very little digging, I think you could say. Essentially, one of the things that Mayor Stewart did was he offered to offload a lot of the mayor's discretionary funds, particularly his international travel fund, to each of the councillors to act as essentially a constituency support fund. What MLAs or MPs get is money to have staffers who will help them out. They'll maintain their calendars. They'll do news briefings on what's going on. They'll research issues that the councillor needs researched of a political nature that they can't get staff to do. And up until now, city councillors have had to operate without any of that, which is, I think, a problem. So they've now got some of it. It's a fairly limited amount of money. And I saw Christine Boyle has now posted hers. So if you're interested, we'll put in the show notes a link to it. You can go and apply to be Councillor Christine Boyle's constituency assistant, essentially. And the job is, if I recall correctly, 15 hours a week at $33 an hour. It's quite a good opportunity if you're looking for a part-time job and you're politically motivated and you're aligned with Christine Boyle. It's my understanding that Gene Swanson, Councillor Swanson, has already hired somebody as well in a similar role, and that person is a Eastside housing activist. And then I've also been told reliably that the Greens have pooled their money, because they're allowed to do, and that they've decided to use their money to hire on their communications manager from the campaign, Alex Brunke, who we chatted with a fair bit during the campaign, and she definitely is going to help corral those councillors together. And I have put a word into the NPA and asked for info on what they're planning on doing, if they're planning on making use of it. I'm waiting to hear back.
This morning, we heard back from Councillor Rebecca Bly of the NPA about her discretionary funds. She says, quote, "I won't be taking the additional $24,000 in discretionary funds for 2019. I was opposed to the process of drawing from our contingency so soon after the budget was approved by council in 2019. She goes on to talk about how she's a new councillor and still trying to learn the day-to-day operations, and asks, how could I effectively direct a full-time political staffer being paid for by tax dollars without that base of knowledge and context? I think it's going to be really interesting to see what difference these staffers and this support makes to these individuals. We've already seen so much activity from some councillors in particular on generating motions and all of that. And once you have support staff to help that, you can do a lot better.
Well, Matthew, you were a constituent assistant for an MLA, so you do have some eye view of what this can be done on a municipal level.
Yeah, I mean, like, there is a big role that, like, this person is going to have to play in terms of coordinating the outreach and, like, abilities of the counselors to basically get out and engage with the community. Because, like, the amount of reading that an MLA or a city councilor has to do it boggles the mind. And
well, I mean, we've done that reading. Like, we've done some of that reading that counselors would have to do on public open houses, and we've only looked at the interesting ones.
Yeah, so, like, they get a binder or two a night, and they're expected to, like, it's actually inhuman, the amount that you have to read. And when that is the amount of reading that you have to do, there is very little time to, like, go and do the event crawling and check out what events are happening at the Croatian Cultural Center and, you know, what the PTA is doing and all of these things that... I think this person is probably going to be responsible for coordinating, especially given the new council's, like, outreach-focused, like, attitude of the past couple months. I think that this is probably a very, very good thing, and I commend Kennedy Stewart for divesting his mayor's budget into the council so that they can hire some actual outreach people and they can act like actual legislators.
He's a true socialist, from each according to their ability to each according to their needs.
No, it's to each according the exact same amount.
True. Very true, actually.
All right. Well, it's getting noisy in here. The election results should start coming in. So before we completely re-gear to Alberta, why don't we head to Alberta Street?
Yeah, I was trying to think up something Alberta-themed but still here in Vancouver to do for our Vancouverada. And anyone who's ridden along Broadway will eventually notice this string of streets that is themed around provinces. And different parts of Vancouver are themed in different ways. And maybe we'll get to the tree section later in a different Vancouverada. But today we thought we'd talk about the provincial streets.
Yes, the eastest part of West Vancouver, or the west side of Vancouver.
That's like where I live.
It is the eastest part of the west side.
And the westest side of the east.
Yeah, but it's not, though. It is still, your address is the first street West, is it not?
And my mother will never forgive me for that.
And I think it's important to note while we're talking about this area of Vancouver that a lot of people will notice we have East and West side of Vancouver, but those don't line up with Main Street. And these stories are all connected to each other. So the story dates back to 1871, where this actually wasn't a white British man. He was born in Upper Canada, but he loved Canada so much that when he moved to...
Wait. He's not a white British man. He was born in Upper Canada. Were his parents white British? Okay.
He was a white subject of the British Empire, but he was a white British Canadian.
And he was good friends with John A. Macdonald. He moves to Vancouver and he loves the area and he decides he's going to buy a bunch of this land because that's what they did.
Speculation is what has driven the development of housing in the city for as long as there has been development of housing in the city.
So he buys up a bunch of what would become Mount Pleasant. And because BC wasn't part of, well, BC wasn't BC at the time. It was two colonies.
We'd taken a pass on Confederation back in 1867, I think.
But
something about not enough railroads.
Dr. Powell was a big proponent
of Canada. We were happy with a wagon road.
Dr. Powell was a big proponent of Canada, so much so that in this little neighborhood he bought and developed, he decided to name his streets after the existing provinces just to remind the locals should be a part of.
Because you could do that back then, just pick your street names.
I mean, and we're still like gradually developing and filling out the set because while we do have indeed Alberta, Columbia, Ontario, Quebec.
The famous province of Columbia.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just irredentism. Like, we want to extend the borders all the way down to the Willamette River. So they are actually adding the missing provinces. Saskatchewan and Nunavut are getting lane names. Nunavut Lane and Saskatchewan Lane are getting added around the Marine Drive SkyTrain site, and they are...
That's right, down in South Vancouver. Yeah. But they won't be part of the set. Yeah.
No, they unfortunately can't bulldoze and add an extra...
I do really enjoy, Ian, your concept about where Ontario sits.
Well...
You noted that the Ontario Street sits right in the middle, as it would.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Powell is a true Ontarian who knows that the center of the universe is in Toronto, and therefore the center of Vancouver street numbering should be Ontario, and that is where our 0-100 block is, rather than Main Street, where it is in every other city in North America.
Well, it wasn't Main Street originally, and as someone who lives on Main Street, I can tell that I personally would prefer it to be called Westminster as it once was.
We have way too many places in the Lower Mainland that have the same name as another place. Let's not add one more.
Really? Because Main Street is so original.
I don't want two Westminsters, the new one and the old one.
Mm. fair point.
So that's the story of the provincial street names in Vancouver.
Great. Well, shall we get to some Alberta election results?
I think first we should remind people to support us on Patreon at...
Patreon.com/CanbyReport.
And if you want, one thing we haven't actually mentioned is we have a voicemail number, and I just got a notification that we haven't used it enough. So if you want to give us feedback, we will play it on a future podcast if we like you or if we think it's funny. And you can call us at 778-806-4120 or just email us an MP3 that you record on your phone at canbyreport@gmail.com. And we'll put those in a future mailbag segment. And,
it is not rude to leave voice messages in this particular instance.
Before we go, any particular predictions that we can have in for posterity's sake?
Premier Kenny?
Yeah. Yeah, UCP majority. And I'm going to say 55 seats.
Yeah, that's probably right.
For the Canby Report.
I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
Good night!